This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. With March Madness upon us, we take a look at the golden age of North Carolina basketball, college basketball, with John Feinstein. His new book, The Legends Club, talks about an exclusive one. There were only three members, Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, and Jim Valvano. They were at the center of an epic rivalry, and we talk about that later in the program. First, a different kind of look in the rearview mirror.
From one end of this state to another. I am so greatly appreciative because today you sent a message.
Hillary Clinton after the South Carolina Democratic primary this Saturday. It sets the stage for the run-up to the Democratic convention in more ways than one. And we're going to get some analysis about what happened, about the thought process of South Carolina voters and more with the man who knows these things well. Andrew Shane is politics and government reporter for the State newspaper in Columbia. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Mike, thank you for having me today.
You're welcome. Everybody expected Hillary Clinton to beat Bernie Sanders in this weekend's South Carolina primary, mostly because of her strength in the African-American community. But did anyone anticipate a victory of this size? It was enormous. She wiped out her opponent.
Oh, she did. I don't think anybody was really expecting this big a victory. I mean, there was one poll that came out last week that had a 50-point spread between the two, and in fact, we thought that was an outlier, to be honest with you, because most of the polls had her winning in the high 20s, 24, 26, 28 points. She did hold a 3-1 lead with African-Americans in those polls. That was a pretty healthy lead. She ended up winning with a 5-1 margin. So, I mean, it clearly Bernie did not resonate with the African-American voters like he hoped, and the African-American voters make up a bulk of the Democratic electorate in South Carolina.
I know he tried, but he wasn't there as much as she was there. And in fact, I think his polling showed him that he was going to be defeated. So he began spending more time in the Super Tuesday states last week than he did in South Carolina. Do you think that hurt him?
I think it sort of sent a signal that he certainly knew that he was not going to win in South Carolina and needed to prioritize some other states in March. And he not only went into Super Tuesday states, but he also went into states later on in March as well that he thought he might have a chance. I think March 15th is an important date for Bernie Sanders. I think that might be fish or cut bait for him, in all honesty. He's, according to the latest polls in the next 20 states that have polling, he was only ahead in two of them. Vermont, his home state, and Massachusetts, which borders his home state. But otherwise, it's looking like a very strong Hillary Clinton march on through the 15th.
Well, she carried, if I'm not mistaken about this, she carried all 46 South Carolina counties. And if that still has held over the weekend as the vote count has been completed, how rare would that be for her to do that?
It's been a while since we've seen it. I don't know if we've analyzed it. The Democrats have only had a primary, not a caucus, since 2004. So, obviously in the few, basically no 408, it's been unprecedented. I just think it just goes to show you that when you get to a state like South Carolina with more diversity than the first three states that we've seen, even though Nevada does have a large, Latino population, he's not resonating beyond white voters, white males especially, and younger voters.
You pointed out earlier in this conversation something about the polls, and in yesterday's article that you wrote for the state newspaper, you said that she beat Sanders by 50%, which is a margin twice as large as predicted by the preliminary polls before the election. Does that tell us anything about polling in the digital age? There have been other surprises with regards to polls so far this year.
Well, just to give the pollsters a break and a little bit, I mean, I know that they've taken some heat, but I would say that the problem was that because Hillary had such a large lead, most polling had actually stopped the week before. We had a large break between New Hampshire and South Carolina. And a lot of the major networks actually didn't poll in the final week. They polled the week before, so a lot of the numbers we were dealing with were 7 or 10 days old at that point. And so even the polls that came out just ahead of the handful of polls that came out just ahead of the election, some of them still had her in the high 20s. As I said, the Clemson poll, kudos to David Woodard down there, had her at 50, which was closer to the mark. So unlike the Republicans, which had a polling like really up until the last day, and there were multiple polls each day right before the primary, we weren't seeing quite that activity. And again, as you mentioned before, Mike, I think, you know, when Bernie did not campaign the entire week in South Carolina, he spent Wednesday, Thursday, and part of Friday in those March primary states. And then he didn't stick around for primary night. He was in Minnesota on primary night. I think that probably led more than a few people not to go to the polls.
Her grip on the black vote was amazing, perhaps historic. I don't know, because I don't have any figures on that. She outdid Barack Obama with black voters down there. And at one point, I was watching the election returns come in on Saturday night. She led Bernie Sanders with 96% of the older black vote to his 3%. Now, that was early Saturday night while they were still counting votes and very little of the return was in. But how did it ultimately turn out with African-American voters?
Again, the numbers pretty much held that course. And, again, older voters tend to go out more often than or higher frequency than younger voters. And again, that's where she was helped a great deal. I would say the hard part about comparing the race of this year to 2008 is that, you know, Hillary Clinton was very much a known entity. You know, Barack Obama back then was not, but he, of course, captured a lot of the attention and a lot of the enthusiasm back then, especially among African-American voters. It was a fairly competitive race for a time, but then slowly but surely Barack Obama just pulled away to the point where he had a 28-point victory over Hillary Clinton back in 2008. So, to a certain degree, I can understand that there was maybe more of a split among African-Americans between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama than there were between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, who was pretty much an unknown entity, an unknown person, until just obviously less than a year ago.
But you point out in your article that African-American voters made up 62% of the primary voters this time around, up from 55% in 2008, which means more people, more African-Americans came to vote for Hillary than came to vote for Barack Obama. How do you explain that?
Well, look at it the other way. We have fewer white voters. And I saw at least one Democratic operative who tweeted out, who said, good news is higher African-American participation, bad news, lower white participation, which sort of showing concerns that maybe we're seeing white flight in the Democratic Party in South Carolina, that they are going more to the Republican Party, just like we have seen as a political shift in the state over the past 30 years, as the state has gone from being a Democratic state to a Republican state. In fact, South Carolina is one of the most Republican states in the country, as far as people who identify themselves as leaning Republican versus leaning Democrat. So, that may be sort of a siren call to the Democrats here in South Carolina that they need to do more to bring back those white voters. And to give you an example real quick is that after Donald Trump won handedly here in South Carolina the week before, I took a look at some numbers from Nikki Haley's 2010 gubernatorial race, Newt Gingrich's surprise win in 2012 in the GOP primary and Trump, and found that they all had about 14 counties in common where they did better than their state average. And in almost all of those counties, they were among the most poor, the least educated, and really had the most concentration of African Americans. So these are, of course, as we know, the African American vote in the Republican primary is negligible. So these are white voters who are living in poor rural counties with usually larger black populations, who for whatever reason feel disengaged from the process, feel disengaged from Washington, and are voting Republican, and let alone are voting Republican, but voting for this Republican who says, I am going to change and shake up the system.
Now, the support that she got this time around, because this was kind of redemption for her. As you mentioned, she lost to Barack Obama when she ran there the first time. And this was kind of redemption for her, but she came out with such a landslide, lopsided victory over Bernie Sanders. Did she have to work hard to gain these votes, or was she simply doing a cakewalk through the state because of support that she has built over the years, dating back, as U.S. Representative Jim Clyburn said, to the 1970s when she came to the state to work with the Children's Defense Fund. Is this just a cumulative accomplishment here over time?
I think some of that. I think you know, the number of people who remember what you did, who remember what you did in the 70s is probably not that high. But what people do remember is 2008, and you know, the first thing she had to do, of course, was for folks who didn't support her or more importantly, angry at her husband's remarks after the race, that, you know, that things had changed. And of course, she had the bona fides to sit here and say, you know, I served in Obama's administration. I have supported the president. I will continue to support the president's measures, especially the Affordable Care Act. And so she was able to sit here and use that those relationships that she had built in 2008. And so she and her surrogates, you know, made incredible inroads well before Senator Sanders was in the picture. So, you know, and we're in the South. It really means a lot that you know somebody versus you don't. And people knew, again, who Hillary Clinton was. And if they didn't know her now, just by her national fame, they knew because they knew her because of the efforts that she made in 2008. So, you know, the interesting part about what you were saying about the cakewalk is that, you know, here she is. She's 28 points ahead come last Monday, you know, a week ago. And here she is announcing a whole slate of stops for herself in South Carolina. Then the next wave was a whole slate of stops for Bill in different places. So she was in some place, Bill was in another. Then the third news release came out. Chelsea's going to be going to college campuses. So at Thursday and Friday, especially on Friday, you had Hillary going out, you had Bill going out, you had Chelsea going out all over the state. I mean, I was joking and sitting here and saying that you know, you're going to turn around and find a Clinton near you. So she took nothing for granted, even though she was up 28, 26 points here in South Carolina. And so she made sure she was going to win the state, and it wasn't taken for granted. And I think that was also a sign to the states up ahead that I'm going to fight for every vote, even though it looks like I'm going to win. I don't think anybody would have blamed her if she took some time off last week and really spent a day going to some of these Super Tuesday states just to solidify things there. She didn't do that.
We have 90 seconds left in this first segment, Andrew, but Hillary Clinton, as you mentioned, tightly embraced Barack Obama and his record throughout this race in South Carolina and pretty much throughout the country. And I suppose that helped with the African-American vote down there. But how effective will this be for white Democratic voters and for independents in the general election if she makes it to the nomination in South Carolina? Do they want somebody to embrace Barack Obama's record?
Well, I mean, in the end, let's just be honest. I mean, and as a political reporter in South Carolina, I can be honest in saying I've seen the last of probably Hillary Clinton and whoever the likely Republican nominee is going to be, which, of course, at this moment looks like Donald Trump. We are very much a red state. We're very much a Republican state. You know, I don't think the Democrats have, you know, they'll speak a lot about, well, we hope we can turn the state. I'm just not convinced that's going to happen, even, you know, especially with Donald Trump as the nominee. So in the end, I don't know if it's going to change anything in South Carolina. You know, it might help. Might what she did here help in some purple states and in some swing states? We'll see.
I'll have to take a break here, Andrew. Hang on just a second. When we come back, I want to talk just a brief moment about Bernie Sanders. I'm going to leave him completely out of the picture here. Andrew Shane's a reporter, a political reporter for the state newspaper in Columbia. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and New Oasis International Education, striving to open the world to Charlotte, one student and family at a time. Now accepting host families for international students. Details available at newoasisedu.com. Lots of changes in the offing for North Carolina voters. Legislators recently redrew congressional districts at the assistance of a federal three-judge panel. Meanwhile, a separate court will determine the fate of the state's election overhaul, which includes voter ID, but voter ID will be required for the first time in the upcoming primary, all of which we'll talk about on this program tomorrow. Now, the primary, the North Carolina primary, is coming up in a couple of weeks, and you're invited to a special live show examining the state's role in the upcoming presidential election. We'll be at McGlowan Theater here at Spirit Square Monday, March 14th, 9 a.m. Save the date. Stay tuned for details. And we are coming right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, analysis of the South Carolina Democratic primary. Then, Iranians vote to elect a new parliament in the first major election since the nuclear agreement. What the results mean for President Rouhani's reforms and selection of the supreme leader.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. On the line with us, Andrew Shane, who is a politics and government reporter for the state newspaper in Columbia. The South Carolina Democratic primary, of course, was on Saturday. Hillary Clinton swept to victory, but there was another candidate in the race. And here's what Bernie Sanders had to say after that primary was over.
What the political revolution is about is revitalizing American democracy and making sure that every American understands that, yes, football is a spectator sport. Democracy is not a spectator sport.
Now, Bernie Sanders has been very successful in capturing the youth vote in other primaries and caucuses. How did he do in South Carolina, Andrew?
He did well among voters under 30. Seemed to be about where his ceiling was. After that, it turned to Hillary Clinton.
So she got almost everything else.
Yep.
Wow. It's really amazing. Now, exit polls in the Democratic primary showed that the economy was the top concern of 40% of the voters in the Democratic primary, and Clinton got 70% of the people who thought that the economy was the problem. She got 70% of their vote. In a general election between a Republican and a Democrat, how important is the economy to the mass of voters in South Carolina?
Well, you know, if you ask Democrats, the economy was the number one issue for them, you know, especially with this idea that there's a lot of inequality at the moment. Of course, wages aren't rising, even though we're in the midst of a recovery from the recession. That was by far the top issue. Among Republicans, the top issue was national security, terrorism, with economy being usually second and then immigration being somewhere either second or third. So we have very different priorities among the folks who back the different parties in the state.
Her victory speech on Saturday night in Columbia was the first time that she really started sounding like the undeniable front runner. It was a speech that reflected themes that I'm sure we're going to hear now for the rest of the campaign, themes of unity, not division, a proclamation that the country doesn't have to return to greatness because it never lost greatness. We just have to come together. These are her words to move forward. And she said, instead of building walls, we need to be tearing down barriers. I would imagine that plays really well with her Democratic base. How will that resonate with independents in South Carolina?
I think it might resonate with some independents. And also we're hearing a lot, I was talking to some people who said they hear that if Hillary gets the Democratic nomination, they're not going to vote for her. They're going to vote for Donald Trump because, again, they want that outsider. They want that person who's going to really shake up Washington. I'm not really sure there's that much crossover, but, I'm sure there'll be a few folks. I think at this point, to be honest with you, the Barack Obama lost South Carolina by near double-digit or double-digit numbers in both of the elections. I don't really see where Hillary will eat too much into that with a Republican, even if it is Donald Trump, who, as we all know, is just there's a lot of controversy there, but I just think that Donald Trump has really resonated with South Carolina voters, especially with, again, those less educated, less wealthy, rural vote, white voters, who I think are coming out, will come at him more.
As Donald Trump has said, he loves the less educated. Andrew Shane is a politics and government reporter for the state newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina. Andrew, thank you for joining us this morning. I appreciate it. John Feinstein has long been one of the nation's most prolific sports writers, focusing not just on the X's and O's, but on the impact of sports on society. And in his latest book, he writes about three men who had a tremendous impact on sports and more specifically on college basketball in North Carolina. For a bright and shining decade, Dean Smith, Jim Valvano, and Mike Krzyzewski were college basketball here. Smith was the king, while Valvano and Krzyzewski were crown princes, and together they were locked into an epic rivalry the likes of which we may never see again. But you can read about that magical time in John Feinstein's book, The Legends Club, and you can hear about it for the rest of this hour. John Feinstein joins us now. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Mike. Good morning.
Good morning. Yours is a book about these three remarkable people coming together to influence basketball, and specifically North Carolina basketball, at the same time. But you say early on that you had always wanted to write a book about Dean Smith, almost from the day you first met him in 1976. Now, you were there meeting Dean Smith as a Duke reporter for the Duke student newspaper. You're a Duke graduate. Why pay any attention to Dean Smith at all?
Well, he, regardless of where you went to school, Dean Smith is on Mount Rushmore when you talk about college basketball coaches, and was an iconic figure even when I was in college back in the 70s, much as I hate to admit it was that long ago. And I, as a basketball fan growing up in New York City, I was a huge fan of North Carolina and of Dean Smith and of the system that he ran. And so, and then when I got to know him, first, as you mentioned, starting with that those few moments in the Carolina locker room in 1976, but then got to know him better when I went to work for the Washington Post, I found him to be a fascinating person. And I think when you do what I do, when you're a reporter, you remember the old Jerry Seinfeld show where he referred to rooting for laundry. You know, you root for the name on the uniform. You don't do that. You judge people individually, regardless of who they play for or where they coach. And I was always a huge admirer of who Dean Smith was as a person and as a coach, and found him, as I mentioned in the introduction, to be tremendously challenging, because Dean never gave you anything easily. He always wanted to know why you were asking a question, why you wanted to do a certain story, why you were going down a particular path during an interview. And I always enjoyed that give and take with him. So, and we did have, for years, we always joked, because Dean would say to me, "You've always been very fair to us," pause, "for a Duke guy." And I would always say, "Why can't you just say, I've been very fair to you, period?" So that was kind of a running joke between the two of us for the, 35 years that I knew him.
Let me ask you a why question. Why do you think he asked you why all the time? I mean, was it just suspicion? Was he overly cautious? Or was he just really interested in your thought process?
I think it was his competitive nature. I think one of the things all three of these coaches have in common, as all great coaches and athletes do, is that they're hyper-competitive, not just competitive. And Mark Wicker, who was a graduate of North Carolina, who's a friend of mine back to my days in college, who now works in Los Angeles, once described Dean Smith as the only man he'd ever met who would compete with you in an interview. And that was a very apt description. And in fact, I brought that up to Dean once, and he said, "Well, what does that mean? How am I competing? Why would you say that? Explain that to me." And I said, "You're doing it right now." And I think, but he also had a genuine curiosity, as you said, about people, no matter who they were, which is why I think he was such a great communicator with his players and with all the people in his life. And one of the most tragic things about the fact that dementia ultimately killed him is that he had the greatest memory of anybody I've ever met. And in the 90s and into the 2000s, when I would go down and find a reason to see him or interview him, he never asked me how my children were. He always asked how Danny and Bridget were. That's the kind of memory he had.
Amazing. You describe him as fascinating, brilliant, driven, generous, manipulative, protective, private, and challenging. How would you describe Mike Krzyzewski and Jim Valvano?
Mike Krzyzewski, many of the same things that Dean Smith was: brilliant, driven, competitive, generous, but much more in your face in terms of when he disagreed with you on something or when he wanted to make a point. Dean would often go through a maze and come out at the other end to make his point, because he didn't want you to really know exactly where he was going. Mike has always said that if he'd ever been president, he would have wanted Dean to run the CIA because he was so good at that sort of thing. Mike's much more in your face, and both in public and in private. And Jim always used humor to deflect everything, including how upset he was about losing. His wife Pam told me when I was working on the book that Jim used his humor to disguise how much losing hurt him, and she told me that she hated it when Jim would schedule a tough game just before Christmas, because if they lost that game on Christmas morning, she couldn't get him to come downstairs and open presents with the three girls. He would be upstairs still brooding, and she would finally go up around 10 or 11 in the morning and say, Jim, it's Christmas morning. You have to come down and open presents with your children, because he took losing so hard. But when you saw Jim in a post-game press conference, or even if you talked to him in a small group or even alone, he would be joking about how he screwed up or why they lost the game. But deep down, he was hurting. But humor was Jim's way of getting things across. Subtlety was Dean's way of getting things across. And in your face has always been Mike's way of getting things.
No one could have predicted at the beginnings of their careers at these three schools that these guys would have had the impact that they had. Dean Smith, I don't think, really wanted the job when he first got the job, but he had a head start on Jim Valvano and Coach K. And when they arrived, they were about the same age, and they arrived almost at exactly the same time, Coach K and Jimmy Valvano, and ended up having this enormous impact, not just on North Carolina, but on the whole sport of college basketball. Put that into perspective. Had that ever happened again, and do you think it will ever happen again?
I can't believe that it will. That's one of the reasons I wanted to do this book, because it struck me, as I described in the introduction, on a night when I had been with Krzyzewski and he and I had been talking about his relationship with Dean and his relationship with Valvano and how they had both evolved, that the notion that you had two of the four coaches who I believe are on Mount Rushmore in college basketball, Mike and Dean, along with, in my opinion, John Wooden and Bob Knight, mm-hmm. coaching 10 miles apart, and then over 25 miles to the east was this unique figure. There's never anybody like Jim Valvano. I doubt if there will ever be anybody quite like Jim Valvano again, in that he had such a combination of brilliance as a coach, extraordinary humor. He was the greatest speaker I ever heard, and I've heard a lot of them through the years. You could not sit through a Jim Valvano talk, whether it was at a press conference or a luncheon or when he was doing a corporate speech, and not end up holding your side laughing so hard. And yet, as Mike said, when he and Jim arrived at NC State and Duke within 9 days of one another, they had no idea how iconic a figure Dean Smith was in the state. And what Mike said was, if we'd landed from Mars rather than from New York, because Mike was coaching at Army and Jim was coaching at Iona in Westchester County, we wouldn't have had any less notion of what Dean meant to people in the state than if we'd landed from New York. And I guess the best story that sort of sums that up was one that Valvano tells about being at the campus barbershop shortly after he got the job, and the campus barber said to him, "Are you the fellow who replaced old Norman Sloan?" And he said, "Well, yes, I am." And he said, "I hope you have more luck than old Norman did here at NC State." And Jim said, "Listen, didn't Norman Sloan go 57-1 and over a 2-year period? Didn't he win a national championship? Didn't he go 27-0 one year?" And the barber said, "Yeah, I guess he did, but just think what old Dean Smith could have done with that team."
How soon after, because these guys came in, Valvano and Krzyzewski came in, as you say, not knowing at all the impact that Dean Smith had in the region and in the state. How soon after their arrival did the competition that we know about today really begin in earnest?
Oh, almost instantly, Mike. The first time that Mike and Dean coached against one another was in the old Big Four tournament. I don't know if you remember that, but they used to play a preseason event in the Greensboro Coliseum, where NC State, Duke, Wake Forest, and North Carolina would come together for two nights at the beginning of the season and play one another. And Duke and North Carolina played on the first night of the Big Four in 1980. It turned out to be the last one that they had. And it was a very close game. And at the end of the game, Duke was down two and missed a shot. Ball went out of bounds. Duke ball. And Krzyzewski thought there should be at least a second left on the clock. But back then, there were no tenths of a second. There was no replay. And the clock went to zero. And the buzzer went off. And Krzyzewski immediately went to the clock operator and started arguing that there should still be time on the clock. So Dean came over, thinking the game was over, put out his hand and said, nice game. And Mike turned around and said, the blank damn game isn't over yet, Dean, and turned back to his argument, with Dean still standing there. Remember, he's a 33-year-old coach just out of Army. And the referee, Hank Nichols, came over, talked to the clock operator, said, game over. Krzyzewski turns around, puts out his hand. Dean shakes hands and starts to walk away, and Mike holds his hand and says, at least admit it was a hell of a game, Dean. And Dean looked at him and said, I'm going to remember that. And Mike said, good, I hope you do. And that was the beginning of what for years was an unbeautiful friendship. It did change later in life, but right away that intensity was there, that Mike was determined to let Dean know that he wasn't going to back down from him, and Dean wanted Mike to know, I'm Dean Smith, we're North Carolina, we're certainly not going to be intimidated by you. Valvano's approach was different. He tried to approach it with humor, and in a tragically ironic twist, his line was, I'll never out-coach Dean Smith, but maybe I can outlive him.
Wow. Yeah, for people who just remember the legends that they came to be, one of the fun things about your book is that you take us back to the beginnings, and they're not auspicious.
True.
When Coach K arrives at Duke, the student newspaper for which he used to work ran the headline that said something along the lines of, Krzyzewski, that is not a misspelling.
No, this is not a typo.
Not a typo, okay.
Right.
Because nobody knew who he was. He didn't have a winning record. He was hired to rebuild Duke basketball. Why him? Why did they hire him?
Well, it's actually a remarkable story how he got hired because, as you said, he was at Army and he'd gone 9-17 in his last year there. And a guy named Steve Sendak, who'd been a star player at Duke in the 1960s, had just come on board as an associate athletic director when Bill Foster decided to resign and go to South Carolina, partly because he felt overwhelmed by the aura of Dean Smith, as did Norman Sloan at NC State. And Sendak had actually seen Krzyzewski work at Army. He was working for Converse, and his high school coach suggested that he go meet Krzyzewski when Army was in Annapolis to play Navy. Steve was living in Annapolis at the time. And he was overwhelmed by this young coach about how organized he was, how smart he was, the way his players reacted to him. And it stayed in the back of his mind. And so when Tom Butters assigned him as an ex-Duke basketball player to kind of start the search for a new coach, there were some logical names. Bob Wentzel had been Bill Foster's top assistant. Bob Weltlich was very successful at Mississippi. He was another Bob Knight guy who Bob Knight actually recommended to Tom Butters for the job.
I'm going to have to stop you. I'll let you finish up on the other side of the break, John, but we have to take a break, and I got to take it on time. John Feinstein, author of The Legends Club, Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, Jim Valvano, and an epic college basketball rivalry. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC-TV's Festival 2016, presenting Pottery Live with Ben Owen III tonight at 8. Information at unctv.org. Hillary Clinton, as we all know, won her resounding victory, her first resounding victory in the 2016 campaign on Saturday, defeating Senator Bernie Sanders in that primary in South Carolina with 73.5% of the vote. She drew overwhelming support from African-American voters. And so, on the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, guest host Susan Page talks with NPR's Ron Elving about what the results could mean as we head into the Super Tuesday primaries tomorrow. More about basketball, the golden age of basketball in North Carolina. When we come back, want to join the conversation? Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org or Facebook or Twitter. We'll get you to us.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
There's only one thing there. It's a galaxy.
An elliptical galaxy 6 billion light years away.
It's your community. we help you understand it.
Councilman Al Austin, who is gay, was passionate for the ordinance expansion.
LGBT people are not aliens.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. John Feinstein is our guest, a sports writer, TV, radio commentator, and author of The Legends Club, about which we are talking this morning. Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, Jim Valvano, and an epic college basketball rivalry. I had to interrupt you in the middle of your story about why Mike Krzyzewski was hired in the first place at Duke, John. So proceed on.
Right. Well, as I said, Steve Ascendak knew of Mike Krzyzewski. Tom Butters, the athletic director, had never heard of him. And Vicendak brought his name to him, and Butters actually called Bob Knight because Mike had played for him at Army and coached under him in Indiana for a year. And Knight recommended Bob Weltlich. He recommended Dave Bliss. He recommended Don DeVoe. He never brought Krzyzewski up. But when Butters asked specifically about Krzyzewski, Knight said, "Let me tell you about him. He's got all of my good qualities and none of my bad." And that intrigued Butters enough to at least interview him. And when he interviewed him, he was blown away by how smart he was, by how he had a plan. But he kept thinking, "I can't hire a coach who had a 9-17 record at Army. We've just been to the NCAA tournament 3 years in a row. We were in the Final Four 2 years ago. I can't introduce a coach no one's ever heard of with an unpronounceable name from Army." And so he kept bringing Krzyzewski back because he couldn't get him out of his mind. And after the third interview, he sent him back to the airport, still not offering him the job. And Steve Ascendak walked in and said, "Well, what do you think?" And he said, "I think he's going to be the next great coach in this country." And Ascendak said, "So you hired him?" He said, "No, I can't hire him. He was 9-17 at Army." And Ascendak said, "If he's going to be the next great coach, how can you not hire him?" And Butter said, "Go back to the airport and get him." So Ascendak drove to the airport, practically pulled him off the airplane that he was about to get on to fly back to New York, brought him back, and Butters offered him the job. And as you pointed out, the reaction all over the state of North Carolina was, "Who in the world is this guy?" And it stayed that way, Mike, really for the next 3 years, because Krzyzewski's first three seasons, he was 38-47, and there were a lot of embarrassing blowouts.
Yeah, he got off to a rocky start. So did Dean Smith. People forgot that they hung Dean Smith in effigy at Carolina.
They did, in his fourth season.
Did those rough starts for these legendary coaches somehow steal them, make them stronger than they might have been had they come in with less resistance?
I think honestly that it did. Dean Smith said often that he learned not to worry about what he couldn't control very early on. He read a book called The Power of Helplessness. Helplessness, I can say that word, by Catherine Marshall. And Dean was very spiritual in many ways, and he wanted to prove that he was a great coach, not a good coach, a great coach. And those first few years, the struggles of those first few years made him even more determined to never go back to where he had been those first few years. And Krzyzewski never forgot what it was like those first few years. And in fact, I tell this story in the book. I was with him, with several other people, in a Denny's at 2 o'clock in the morning, the night they had lost to Virginia, 109-66 in the ACC tournament in 1983. And somebody at the table, the Duke SID, a guy named Tom Mickle, picked up a water glass and said, "Here's to forgetting tonight." And I cannot repeat on the radio exactly what Krzyzewski said, but within that sentence were the words, "Here's to never forgetting tonight." And eight years later, when they won the national championship, I went out on the court, as the media does at the end of the national championship game, and I walked up to congratulate Krzyzewski, and the first thing he said to me was, "We've come a long way from the Denny's, haven't we?" So he never forget that. He never did forget that night.
What about Jimmy V? What were the expectations for him when he came in from Iona? Was NC State a competitor at the time?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the irony is that Krzyzewski and Valvano both replaced very successful coaches. Norm Sloan had won a national championship, as I mentioned, in 1974. NC State was in the NCAA tournament in 1980. Bill Foster had been to the national championship game in 1978. Duke ended up in the Elite Eight in 1980. They both left because they believed that no matter what they did, they would never get the credit they deserved as long as they were coaching in the same triangle area as Dean Smith. I mean, Bill Foster used to always say, I thought it was Naismith who invented the game, not Dean Smith. And that frustration really drove them both off. So when Valvano took over, he had three very good young players in place, and Derek Wittenberg, Sidney Lowe, and Thurl Bailey. And they were going to be sophomores his first year. And they struggled a little bit, but then they got a little better the next year. And then when the three of them were seniors, you know what happened with that extraordinary national championship run that's been chronicled so many times. Krzyzewski was left with more of a bare cupboard. He had two very good seniors in Gene Banks and Kenny Denard, who'd been freshmen on the Final Four team. Once they graduated, though, he was almost back to square one. And his first recruiting season was a complete wipeout. They were second for five players. And as you know, second only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades and coming close. And so it didn't help him. Chris Mullen almost came to Duke, but almost doesn't count.
Yeah.
And so for those next 2 years, he really struggled before the class of Johnny Dawkins and Jay Billis and Mark Gallery and David Henderson really turned the program around.
You mentioned that Krzyzewski and Dean Smith got off to a rocky start in terms of their personal relationships, and you also write that Krzyzewski didn't like Jim Valvano at first, but he now says that there's probably no one that he's been closer to. He says, we said things to one another that men almost never say to one another. How did that transformation, and when did that transformation happen?
Well, they coached against each other at Army and Iona. Both being in New York, they would play each other every year. And when Jim, of course, was the star at the writers' lunches every week in New York, even though Lou Carnesecca coached at St. John's, which was the power school in the city, Valvano always went last because he was Sinatra and everybody else before him was the lounge act. And Mike did just, they were so different. Mike always said, I don't want to be like him. And then he would say, pause and say, of course, I couldn't have been like him if I wanted to. And when they were competing against each other at Duke and NC State, it was intense. But when Jim got out of coaching, when his career ended at NC State, and ended badly, as you remember,
right.
he stopped paying attention as much as a coach needs to after the national championship. They brought in some questionable students. There was an NCAA investigation, which actually only found minor violations, not major ones, as people sometimes think. But when Jim was in trouble, Krzyzewski stood up for him publicly, and Valvano remembered that. And when Valvano got into TV, they began to spend more time together and became much more friendly. But it was only when Jim got sick, when he had cancer, that they got as close as you just described. Mike would visit Jim in the hospital. Jim was in Duke Hospital almost every night the last few months of his life. And Pam Valvano said to me that when Mike would walk into the room at night, he would come over there after practice every day. When Mike would walk into the room, Jim didn't have cancer anymore. That Jim needed to be with someone who he considered a peer as a coach, someone he could talk to as a coach. And the two of them spent all those hours together laughing and crying and talking about things that, as Mike said, men don't normally talk to one another about. And Mike was actually in the room with Jim's family on the morning that Jim died. That's how close they had become.
Wow. At one point in the book, you say that Jim Valvano called you his therapist. Is that correct?
I'm sure there were others. I think it was just, I used to go to NC State games frequently because I wanted to hang out after the game. Jim was not a coach who would go back and look at tape the way many coaches do. After a game, he would have friends into his office. They would order pizza and wine and beer, and Jim would hold court. But eventually, everybody would leave, and it would be just Jim and I. And it would be about 3 o'clock in the morning, and Jim had a couch there in his office, and he would stretch out on the couch, and he would say, "Okay, now you're my therapist." And he would talk about his confusion after winning the national championship, because that had been his only goal in life, to cut down the final net. That's what he called it. When he would do clinics for high school kids at summer camps, he would talk about cutting down the final net, and he would make the kids at the end pick them up on their shoulders, and he would cut down one of the nets in the gym. And the guy who at the five-star camp, Howard Garfinkel, who owned the camp, used to go crazy because he always had to replace the net whenever Jim did a clinic, but it was worth it because Jim was so good. But after they won in Albuquerque, that miracle win over Houston, Jim felt like he had, to use his words, done coaching. He was 37. What did he do next? He didn't want to just be a coach. He wanted to be something else, but he didn't know what. He tried his hand at comedy. He tried his hand at doing TV, both games. He did the CBS morning show. He'd fly up Sunday night, do the show Monday morning, and fly back. He did stand-up comedy. He sold blue jeans. He sold lithographs. He tried to be an entrepreneur. But nothing really gave him that kind of high that coaching had. And the great tragedy in Jim Valvano's life was that the next thing for him turned out to be cancer. Because after he was diagnosed, he spent the last 11 months of his life setting up the Jimmy V Foundation, talking to people like Krzyzewski about what he wanted them to do after he died to build that foundation. Mm-hmm. And as you know, that's the Jimmy V Foundation has raised something like $150 million for cancer research. And in another twist, Jim, in that famous ESPY speech, said that the Foundation may not save my life, but it might save one of my children's lives. And his daughter, Jamie, had cancer a few years ago. And thanks to some of the new research that's been done, she survived and is completely healthy.
Wow. You say that Coach K believes that Jim Valvano would have gone on to become a David Letterman had he lived. Really? I know he was funny, and he was a raconteur, and Dean Smith's wife say that when he walked into a room, he didn't own the room. He became the room. That's a kind of a personality that I'm not even sure television can contain.
It's a very good point. It's a very good point. And I don't know that that would have been what Jim ended up doing, something like that. I know that he was a very brilliant guy, and I don't say that about a lot of people in sports, but he read voraciously. The irony is Krzyzewski had the reputation as sort of being the bookworm because he'd gone to Army and he was so studious, but Mike believes he's ADD and that he was just never diagnosed as a kid, whereas Jim read book after book after book. I remember sitting with him on a bus while he was reading Perestroika back in the late 1980s and him saying to me, Soviet Union's gone within a year. He was off by 4 months. It was gone 16 months later.
Wow.
And he really did study many different things, and he had an unbelievable memory, much like Dean had an unbelievable memory. And so I'm not sure that would have been where he went, but I believe he would have done something beyond sports had he lived.
What is really interesting is you have these three enormous figures in sports, in college basketball, who not only have an outsized influence on the sport, but on the young players with whom they worked, and they're so different. I mean, the idea that you, as a reporter, could sit in Jim Valvano's office at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and let him talk to you about all these things, and I suppose these conversations were off the record, but still you were a reporter. On the other hand, you have Dean Smith, who never liked to be interviewed and always wanted to deflect the credit to somebody else. How do you explain that?
Well, I think that Dean was a classic, you know, not to generalize, but he's a classic Midwesterner. And I think the line that sums Dean Smith up that I've repeated often was something he said to me in 1981. I was doing a long profile on him for the Washington Post. It was like pulling every tooth in his mouth to get him to agree to sit for a lengthy interview. He finally agreed to let me do it driving in his car to Charlotte on the way to the old North-South doubleheader. So I had 2.5 hours with him in the car. Back then he was still smoking, and it was February, and it was pretty miserable, but it was worth it. While I was researching the story, I went to talk to his minister, the Reverend Robert Seymour, who's still alive. And Reverend Seymour was the one who told me the story about Dean being involved in integrating restaurants in Chapel Hill by walking into a segregated restaurant with a black member of the church. And when I went back to Dean looking for details on that story, he looked at me and he said, "Who told you that story?" And I said, "Reverend Seymour." And he said, "I wish he hadn't told you that." And I said, "Dean, you should be proud of doing something like that." And he said, "John, you should never be proud of doing the right thing. You should just do the right thing."
Wow.
And I really believe that's the way he lived his life. That's the way he felt. Mike Krzyzewski always said that if Dean could have just been beamed into practice and into the games and never been in public, he'd have been much happier. He was reticent that way. He was a shy man, except around his inner circle. Whereas Valvano was the single most outgoing person I've ever met in my life. And by the way, in those conversations that we had late at night, he never once said to me, this is off the record. He just talked.
Wow.
And I think there was an understanding that there were certain, when he talked about his daughters or things like that, he knew I wasn't going to write about it. But there were a lot of issues he talked about that I did write about.
We have about a minute left here. Krzyzewski started his tenure as pretty high-strung and profanity-slinging and barking and things like that. He's become among the most gracious coaches in victory or defeat. Is that because of the experience level, because the pressure has changed, because he's now eclipsed Dean Smith in terms of a winning record? Why the change?
Actually, I don't think he's changed, Mike. I think he was always gracious in defeat. I think having gone to West Point taught him about dealing with adversity and how to handle it and learn from failure, which is something they teach you at West Point. But as far as the intensity and the profanity, that hasn't changed at all. He is every bit of, quickly, Jeff Petrie, who is the general manager of the Portland Trailblazers, went and saw him coach in person for the first time ever about 3 years ago. And a friend asked him walking out of the building that day what he thought of the game. He said, I thought it was remarkable that the most intense person in the gym was the 66-year-old coach on the Duke bench. That hasn't changed at all.
Wow. John Feinstein writes about all three of these men, and they are incredible people. Dean Smith, Mike Krzyzewski, and Jim Valvano in a book called The Legends Club, about an epic college basketball rivalry. But of course, if you live in North Carolina, you already know that. But there are a lot of things in this book that you may not know. John Feinstein, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Mike, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.